Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Our entire hour, Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. A look at the truth behind America's aggression against Vladimir Putin and Russia, and the emergence of a Vatican-Russian Orthodox alliance, something that is not discussed at all anywhere in the mainstream or alternative media. From Santa Cruz, California, we have Danny Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-A-N. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. He is the people's lawyer. During his more than 45 years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers. In fact, without Danny greenlighting the project, the New York Times would never have published it. The Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, the Karen Silkwood murder case. He has represented victims of the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute. And he is also the author of The People's Advocate. His website is romeroinstitute.org, as well as dannypsheehan.com. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific. Thank you, Gary. It's great to be here.
If you were to read the mainstream media, as well as listening to much of the alternative media, including programs on Pacifica, you would think that Vladimir Putin was representing the new head of the Axis of Evil. He has been called by Hillary Clinton the new Hitler. The Russian people have been demonized as if they're nothing more than uneducated clones following in whatever his dictates are, and therefore justifying the NATO buildup around its borders and posturing all of our resources towards a new Cold War and possibly a hot war. Now today, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in particular are so intent on demonizing and isolating Putin and Russia as a global threat that it's their number one priority. In fact, every time I channel around to see how different topics are being handled, even Megyn Kelly on Fox allows a so-called truth by every single one of the Democrats on that, A, you can't trust any of these email leaks from Julian Assange because they're all coming from Russia. And by the way, she accepts that without challenge. I have to ask, where's your proof? Prove it. Show me any proof, viable proof, that Russia was the source of all these leaks. That Russia managed to get into the National Security Agency, the Justice Department, the State Department, the Pentagon, download those files, show us the proof. Surely if you have it, you would have presented it. So it's propaganda. But that's the propaganda that's led to them saying, ah, not only is Russia a threat, but also we must change the regime of Assad in Syria, as we did with Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, even Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, to promote peace, democracy, and freedom. And then the mainstream media, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, or programs on Pacifica, which are aligned with the Clintons, continue to promote these demonization. So the question is, why after our supporting a neo-fascist coup in Ukraine and then orchestrating economic sanctions against Russia, has the United States' stance against Russia become so belligerent, aggressive, and militaristic? Even our military generals and officers are warning that a Clinton presidency may lead to a third world war, and worse, a nuclear exchange. She has gone on the record, Hillary Clinton is stating, that all nuclear options are on the table against Russia and Iran, or allowing without challenge or debate Israel to do a preemptive strike, a nuclear strike, against Iran. What is the ultimate outcome desired? Is it regime change? Take us on this journey, because you've been to Russia, you have been behind the scenes, you have done your meticulous investigative reporting. Share with us what the media has not shared, even though they had the resources. They have chosen not to share the story you're about to tell us. The forum is yours.
Okay, thank you, Gary. Look, I think that one of the most important single facts that people need to really understand is at the end of the Cold War, on December 31st of 1991, when Gorbachev specifically signed the authorization for the potential dissolution of the Soviet Union to try to end the Cold War, that Gorbachev had been planning to do this for some time, that we became involved in this. I was at the Jesuit National Headquarters in Washington, D.C., all the way from 1975 to 1985. During that period, we sent one of my staff people, Dr. James Garrison, not the one from New Orleans, but Dr. Jim Garrison, who was a classmate of mine at Harvard Divinity School. He was my staff person on nuclear weapons policy at the Jesuit National Headquarters in our social ministry office. And he went to Russia at our request. Specifically, this was still early on in early 1980s. Because we were extremely concerned that under the Reagan-Bush administration, that there was a desire on the part of the Reagan-Bush administration to goad the Soviet Union into a nuclear confrontation. And they were, in fact, engaging in a strategic arms limitation talk, the so-called SALT talks, where they were refusing to start to limit the number of nuclear weapons. They were just agreeing to not build more. They would reduce the number. They were going to be building new weapons every year. And so we decided to take an initiative on this to try to reach out to the Soviet Union and to try to bring down the number of nuclear missiles. Because of all of that, this is when Brezhnev was still the president. And Dr. Garrison went over to Russia and ended up meeting with the people around him and started a process of trying to back out of this Cold War. And when Brezhnev died and Andropov came in, Dr. Garrison was trying to set up a set of meetings with Andropov through Shevardnadze, who was the foreign minister at the time. And Shevardnadze said, no, you don't want to meet with Andropov. He will be gone soon. You want to meet with Gorbachev. Gorbachev, who was just the Secretary of Agriculture at that time, is going to be the new president. And so Dr. Garrison met with Gorbachev prior to Gorbachev's even ascending to the presidency and made this offer to him. That if we in the United States, working with all 54 of the major religious denominations in the United States, could pressure the Reagan-Bush administration, that if we could pressure them to start to disassemble a certain percentage of the nuclear warheads, would the Soviet Union respond? And Gorbachev said to Dr. Jim Garrison, said, no, they will never initiate this. We have to do this. The Soviet Union needs to begin this process of backing out of the Cold War. And I will undertake these steps when I become president. We'll start to disassemble some of our nuclear missiles. I'm going to eventually agree that we can allow the other republics to withdraw from the Soviet Union if they wish to. But you're going to have to become the head of the Gorbachev Foundation that can carry on this work, because when I start this process, they will come for me in the night. The right-wing, hardcore military people in the Soviet Union will come for me and disappear me. And so you're going to have to continue this process. So my staff person on nuclear weapons policy, Dr. James Garrison, became the president of the Gorbachev Foundation with Mikhail Gorbachev. And when Gorbachev, on December 31st of 1991, signed the agreement allowing all of the different republics in the Soviet Union to withdraw if they chose to, and effectively dissolved the Soviet Union and took a step away from the Cold War, he had a meeting, this is extremely important, he had a meeting in Malta Gorbachev with George H.W. Bush in December of 1989. And he entered into an agreement at that time, Gorbachev, with H.W. Bush and Bush's Secretary of State, James Baker, that if, in fact, he would go forward and do this and would agree to have the new reunified Germany come into NATO, that they would agree, and this was the W. Bush administration, or excuse me, the George H.W. Bush administration and James Baker, they would agree not to expand NATO one single inch to the east. They agreed to that specifically. And this has been confirmed by major studies. Mary Surratt published a major article in the Diplomatic History Journal in 2010, which included interviews with all the people that were involved in those meetings. And there was a major study that was also done by Der Spiegel in Germany to confirm that agreement had been entered into. And what happened is when W. Bush came into power in the year 2000, right when Putin had come in to be the new president in Russia, the W. Bush administration with Dick Cheney as the vice president completely violated those agreements and began making hardcore moves to recruit virtually every one of the republics along the border, that western border of Russia, to become members of NATO. And in fact, they did that. In that period of time, they brought in seven new members of NATO, which included all of the republics along the western border of Russia with Europe, in complete violation of that agreement. So that became the key to this thing. The hardcore neocons that were previously in the administration of George H.W. Bush, that were all in the Defense Department under Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Fife and all of these fellows, David Addington, that were in there, they were all Cheney's people that had been advocating this project for a new American century. When they came into power in 2001 with W. Bush under the cover of W. Bush, basically it was the Cheney administration and all of these guys from the Project for a New American Century with Donald Rumsfeld, Cheney, David Addington, Douglas Fife, Elliot Abrams, the people that were the primary signatories to this Project for a New American Century, they came in complete violation of that agreement that had been entered into with Gorbachev on the part of H.W. Bush, the father, and James Baker. They began to recruit all of those countries along the western border of Russia into NATO. Now, that's extremely important to understand, because the challenge that we're faced with is that the activities that were undertaken by the W. Bush administration or the Bush-Cheney administration during that terrible eight-year period when they, after two elections, in the year 2000 election and in the year 2004 election, clearly engaged in stealing those elections with the violations of the voting rules in Florida and Ohio specifically, they usurped power. They came into power, and what they did is they began a campaign to try to isolate Russia and to surround Russia with NATO countries, and began to move into those countries anti-ballistic missile systems and put them in all of those countries to surround and fence in Russia. They were then making their move on the Ukraine. The Ukraine was the country at the southernmost edge of that crescent where they were trying to surround the Soviet Union, and they began to try to stimulate the overthrow of the government in the Ukraine. And this became obvious. And what happened is, people don't understand this. The reason that the United States, the people in the Bush administration, the W. Bush and Cheney administration, were trying to surround Russia and to take over the Ukraine, because the Ukraine contained Crimea, which was the sole warm water port for Russia. This is extraordinarily important because the Bush-Cheney administration was attempting to complete a encircling all of Russia right on their very borders. It's just as if Russia were reaching out and establishing an alliance with Mexico and Cuba and Canada, trying to bring them into the Warsaw Pact, and started building a whole ring of missiles around the United States. That's precisely what the Bush-Cheney administration was doing. And what happened is Putin was trying to recover his country, because his country at the very end of the Cold War, it happened just as Gorbachev had predicted. And many people forget this part of history, is that when Gorbachev was moving forward doing the exact things that he had agreed he was going to do, when he talked with Dr. Jim Garrison from my staff and started allowing these liberal reforms with Glasnost and Perestroika, what happened is he was in fact kidnapped. He was kidnapped by the military and disappeared for days, and just exactly as he predicted. But what had happened is that the people rose up against that military coup and insisted that they free Gorbachev and released him. But what happened was a compromise was struck, and Yeltsin took over during that period. My dear friend, Dr. James Garrison, as a close associate of Gorbachev, you know, is the guy who went around with Yeltsin as he was becoming the new head of Russia, and was completely stunned and shocked at this guy, a complete, total alcoholic, you know, who Jim called me many times, having to put Yeltsin in a shower with all of his clothes on to try to sober him up, to get him to meetings that he had to go to. It was a disaster that period. And the mafia in Russia, the whole Russian mafia, began to rise to power. There was a terrible disintegration of the structures of Russian government during that period of time. It was similar to the kind of activities that the W. Bush administration with Cheney was undertaking that drove our country into this huge, massive recession that took place. So that period of time was a very dangerous time in the world, when our United States government was under the dominion of W. Bush and Cheney and the Project for a New American Century, that was pushing its imperial power around the world and attempting to militarize, to increase the massive military spending of the U.S., to project U.S. military power throughout the whole world. And at the same time, the Soviet Union was having this terrible time under Yeltsin. What happened is two people came to power at the end of those two periods. In the United States, Obama came into office in 2008, and in Russia, Putin came into power in 2000. And they were both attempting to kind of restabilize their countries. The serious problem that happened here in the United States is that Obama and Hillary Clinton, as his Secretary of State, they continued to acknowledge and legitimize the totally illegitimate activities that have been undertaken on the part of the W. Bush and Cheney administration, which included, of course, the entire invasion of the Middle Eastern oil fields, the occupation of the oil fields to try to shut off the access to the Middle Eastern oil on the part of China, and that long-term strategy to isolate China. And they also continued to try to figure out how they could cherry-pick the illegal and violative activities that had been undertaken by the W. Bush and Cheney administration against Russia. They cherry-picked as many of those advantages as they could maintain, and they decided they were going to continue that policy of attempting to isolate Russia, to take strategic advantage of this unique period in history where there was a chance to completely isolate Russia and to subjugate it. so that it could then become part of a longer-term plan of having Russia and the United States and the Western powers be able to turn our attention to isolating China in the future. That is the strategic play that is going on at this time. What they did not anticipate, clearly the W. Bush and Cheney administration did not anticipate two things. Number one, the extraordinary pushback that occurred in the Middle East on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood, this mobilization of thousands of members of the Wahhabist fundamentalist Islamicists who rose up against the invasion and occupation of the Middle Eastern oil fields, and they did not anticipate that Russia was going to be able to regain its footing and to reestablish itself so that it would not become just a minion of this Western strategic plan to join together all of Russia and Europe and the Western powers against China. This is that long play that it was being set forth at the end of the Cold War by Samuel P. Huntington. And remember, this is a critical thing. Everybody who is listening today should, in fact, get a copy of Samuel P. Huntington's book called The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. This was originally published right at the end of the Cold War in the magazine, Foreign Policy Magazine, which is, in fact, the major mouthpiece of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the Trilateral Commission, which is it was set up by David Rockefeller. This and Samuel P. Huntington was, in fact, the principal editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He was also the president of the American Academy of Political Science. He was also the John Olin Institute head at Harvard University for International Relations. And this fellow is an extraordinarily important person. He laid out this entire plan in which he proposed that all of the Western powers mobilize and to mobilize against China, the potential rise during the 21st century of a new Asian empire under the leadership of China. And this is the strategic play that is underway right now, and that both the W. Bush and Cheney administration and later the Obama-Clinton administration, basically, bought into this thing. And that what they were trying to do is they were trying to demoralize and diminish Russia so that Russia would then have to come in and become part of this entire basic Western alliance. They wanted to have capitalism be able to take place in Russia. They wanted to have Russia be a minimal power, just like another one of the European powers, and to bring them into their fold. And so part of the tactic was to surround Russia along its entire Western border with this crescent of members of NATO, raise up in those countries a huge missile shield of building anti-ballistic missile bases all in those countries, and isolating Russia, cutting it off from its only warm water port, and having a major pipeline built from all the way from the Caspian Sea up in Russia, where they could pump the oil out of Russia through a pipeline through Afghanistan down to the Indian Ocean. That was the plan. That's the major strategic plan that was underway. And what happened is that Putin came into office, and he was successful step by step in kind of restabilizing Russia and reasserting Russia, reestablishing its economic base, taking action against the major Russian mafia, organized crime people, starting to reduce the corruption that was going on at the time. And so that was unanticipated on the part of the W. Bush and Cheney administration, and it was unanticipated by the Obama-Clinton, basically, administration. So And they also, as I said, had not anticipated the powerful pushback that was going to be occurring in the Middle East on the part of the Wahhabists, the fundamentalist Islamic people. And so that is what happened. The huge destabilization began to happen right during that period, during the Obama administration, with Clinton as the Secretary of State. And what happened is, the Wahhabists all through the Middle East began to rise up and overthrow the dictators that had been put in place way back at the end of World War I. At the end of World War I in 1922, there was a major commission that the Western powers, after the victory in World War I against Germany and the Turkish Empire, what they did is they set up a commission with 22 people in it, 21 men and one woman, all Westerners, all white people. They set up a commission, and they superimposed upon the entire Middle East a whole set of completely arbitrary boundaries, setting up these purported nation states in the Middle East that superimposed these rigid boundaries that completely ignored the actual thousands of years of tribal communities in the Middle East. They superimposed these boundaries so they could take the oil out of the Middle East and claim that oil. They established a boundary like with Jordan and Libya and Yemen and all these arbitrary country boundaries. And then they unilaterally selected one of the tribes, the tribal families, and made them the royal leaders of that, almost like medieval European culture. They superimposed on them these artificial boundaries and handpicked specific families, the royal family of Kuwait, the royal family in Iran, the Pahlavi family in Saudi Arabia. They picked Abdul Aziz, the head of the House of Saud. They gave them the authority to become the potentates in those regions on the condition that they would personally sign an agreement assigning all of the oil inside those areas to a new company called the Arab American Oil Company, Aramco, which was a big coalition of seven major Western oil companies owned by the Rockefellers and others. And that was how the world order was established at the end of World War I. What we saw is that the voluntary dissolution of the Soviet Union on December 31st of 1991, what happened is that those potentates that had been put in place, those families that had been put in place by the Western powers at the end of World War I, were overthrown by the rising up of this Islamic fundamentalist jihad, and basically pushed out those people, and they fell from power one after another and radically destabilized that entire area of the world. Now, this was predicted very specifically by Zbigniew Brzezinski. Zbigniew Brzezinski, right at the end of this Cold War, in let's call it the beginning of 1992, since it was December 31st of 1991. In 1992, these articles started being published, like the article in Foreign Policy magazine by Samuel Huntington. There was another major article written by Zbigniew Brzezinski called Out of Control, the Threat of Global Turmoil on the Eve of the 21st Century. It's another extraordinarily important book that people should get, because he specifically predicted that this was going to happen, that this huge dissolution of these nation-states, artificially created nation-states, was going to take place with the power vacuum that had been created by the Soviet Union voluntarily stepping back from the Cold War that had gone on for 70 years since the end of World War I in 1917, with the rise to power in Russia of the Bolshevik Revolution that overthrew Nicholas I, overthrew the Tsar, and established the Soviet Union. Now, with the voluntary withdrawal of Gorbachev from the Cold War, that what happened, we've talked about this in other shows, that that time the George H.W. Bush administration, with Dick Cheney as his Secretary of Defense, what they did is they saw this as this extraordinary opportunity, despite the fact that there had been this agreement that was made back in 1991 between Baker, with George H.W. Bush. Well, 1989 December was the original agreement, and then later in October of 1990, a year before the dissolution of the Soviet Union, this specific agreement had been established at Malta, in which the George H.W. Bush administration and James Baker, his Secretary of State, agreed on behalf of the United States that they would not take untoward advantage of this extraordinary strategic step that had been taken by Gorbachev to step back from the Cold War. And what Gorbachev did is Gorbachev, right at the end of the Cold War, he established the State of the World Forum. Dr. James Garrison, my dear friend, who was my staff person at the Jesuit headquarters, became the head of the State of the World Forum. The State of the World Forum was established in 1992 to try to bring together all of the former presidents of the United States, vice presidents, secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, and all of the major leaders of the religious denominations around the planet, and a lot of the CEOs of the major business organizations, to bring them together at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco, the same hotel where at the end of World War II the United Nations had been formed and the meetings held there. And we ran those meetings. That Jim Garrison ran those meetings. The executive director of those meetings was Sarah Nelson, my wife of 37 years, and the director of our Christic Institute and the director of our Romero Institute. And we brought together these heads of now retired heads of state to try to establish a new, more cooperative, more mutually beneficial kind of world ethos. And that was what we were engaged in at the time. The problem is that W. Bush and Dick Cheney, these right-wing reactionaries, fascists, in fact, that had been inside the George H.W. Bush administration, they came to power in the United States and brushed aside all of these agreements, all of these efforts to bring about a peaceful and more cooperative resolution of world affairs. And they decided they were going to take extraordinary advantage of this opportunity to push forth U.S. military power. And as I've touched on it earlier, they, in fact, the very week after December 31st of 1991, in that very first week of 1992, came together at the White House, now still under the administration of George H.W. Bush, his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, gathered a group of people together, Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith and David Addington and Elliot Abrams, and these guys all met in the West Wing, and they drafted up a 1992 United States Defense Department policy planning guidance document explicitly stating, look, people are going to now hear at the end of this Cold War, after 70 years of the threat, daily threat of nuclear holocaust, everybody's going to want to reduce the military budget and establish peace. Let's not let that happen. They said, let's in fact increase the military budget, let's project our U.S. military power throughout the world and establish full spectrum dominance over the planet. It's explicitly stated in the document that is what they were planning to do. Now that's an extraordinarily important thing to keep in mind, because that is the exact mentality that dominated the United States prior to the creation of the Soviet Union in October of 1917. That entire period up to 1917, from the end, yes.
Danny, I'd like for you to hold your thoughts, because we need to now focus upon today.
Yes.
And I want to give you some
of what's happened. Yes.
It's a brilliant background. It's a 33-minute background. But now we need to get specific. Please address the following issues that I find important, because in my personal opinion, what you have now is you have a cabal, a a cabal of individuals. If you look carefully at the pieces, you won't see this if you're a part of it or if you're merely looking from the outside. But each administration is allowed to bring any number, and some have brought up to 4,000 people in to help run their administrations. When a person leaves office after 4 to 8 years, these people are not required to leave. They're the stay-behinds. Almost always, these are considered the best and brightest. They come from your Ivy League schools. They share certain common social, cultural, and ideological similarities.
That's right.
And that's why, if you look at the head of the CIA, the head of the Justice Department, the head of the FBI, all these people used to work for Bill Clinton. They all worked for Clinton at one time. Podesta worked for Clinton. He was head of his chief of staff. So when you see that it doesn't matter, and here's the key, it is irrelevant whether you're Republican or Democrat, whether you're conservative or liberal, you are ideological, and you're serving the interests of the larger core group behind you, some known, most unknown. This is the secret society. This is the silent hand. This is the silent state working in unison. And therefore, they select you based upon your harmonizing with their values. Now, let's just say that you don't have an impeachment of someone in power. You don't have a grand jury that could have gotten information on Hillary Clinton. That's not by accident. And they have plausible deniability. There doesn't have to be a meeting on an airplane for that to occur. It's known that if you're putting someone in position of power, there's an allegiance that you must abide by. It's like any guild, sorority, fraternity, club. There's first and foremost, like the blue shield, the white coat shield of doctors protecting doctors. You first look after those that support you. Now, you start looking over the last 30 years, you start seeing the same identical cast of characters show up. Wolfowitz has been there. Fife has been there. Ellington has been there. Cheney has been there. Rumsfeld has been there. Bushes have been there. The Clintons have been there for decades. And it doesn't matter who's in office, they still have one agenda, the neoliberal hegemony construct of we are the neoliberalists, but we're going to give the public neo-fascism. So then my question is, can you defeat neo-fascism with neoliberalism? And the answer is self-evident. It's not possible. But then you control the media, which is apparent and obvious from the emails, as well as our own intuition on this. So I'm seeing that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, what will likely occur is that no matter what promises she has made, look at the promises she and her husband and Barack Obama all made prior to being elected. Now, how many of them did they honor? None of them. So if you think, if you're naive enough, if you're that intentionally, willingly disingenuous to say, well, we're sure that if we elect Hillary Clinton, then she will turn a new leaf and she's the most important, powerful woman in the world and she'll become a humanist and she'll become truly progressive because we're progressive. The people saying this are not progressive. They are, like it or not, a part of this whole mindset. They are not Ralph Nader. They're not Jim Garrison, who we've had on this program many times. They are not Cornel West. They are not Glenn Ford. They're not Danny Sheehan. They're not true progressives, because true progressives would work in coalitions to build a new group of people who could go forward at the local, state, national level, lose this election, yes, but lose it with the principle that you're creating something more powerful for the next cycle. The neoliberals will say, well, you don't want the worst of two evils, so let's give us the one least likely to cause a problem. Meaning, is she less likely to cause a war? She is a warmonger. She's caused wars. Is she less likely to invade other countries? She's already done invading countries. Look at Libya. Look at Syria. Look at her husband and her in Iraq. Look at what they didn't do in Rwanda. Look what she did in 15 years of representing Tyson Foods and Walmart. She was anti-union labor. She was anti-women's rights. Look what her and her husband did with their policies of defending the taking away of welfare rights for women and their families who desperately need it. Well, was she for those black kids who are now homeless? Or was she for the black people and people of color who had a little marijuana on them and now they're in prison for 7 to 12 years with a permanent record and denied Pell Grants, denied opportunity for public housing? So you've got two dynamics at work here. You have the reality of what they've done, And then you have this pixie dust of the Michael Moore mindset that she'll do what we're telling her to do, and if not, then he will he actually said this this morning, believe it or not. He'll personally run for president. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, my God, has this devolved in such delusional self-interest? You're in denial. Now, who is the one most likely to create a nuclear war? She and Obama have upped the ante to $1.5 trillion and are promising nuclear proliferation, and nuclear is on the table. You look what she has done in spying on every single governmental agency in the world, including all of her so-called allies, including Merkel. So we get bent out of shape when it turns out that someone's hacked her emails. But what about her hacking every single employee at the UN, every single ambassador, wanting to get every tip they can on them, their sexual habits, get their DNA? They even had it at one time, I don't know if you remember this, where she was wanting people at the UN working through the CIA to go to cocktail parties to get glasses after people have drank from them so they could get their DNA. I mean, the line of rationale that these people are going to change and suddenly go from being rampant neocolonialists, rampant corporatists, rampant warmongers, rampant support from the neocons. Look who's supporting Hillary Clinton. Virtually every neocon, everyone you just mentioned, all of them are endorsing her. Every corporate Fortune 500 major corporation endorsing Hillary Clinton. Everyone on Wall Street endorsing Hillary Clinton. Every one of the major war contractors endorsing Hillary Clinton. All the major media endorsing Hillary Clinton. All of the major agricultural companies like in Monsanto, a part of the Clinton machine. So if everyone who creates war, creates corporatization, exploits the environment, is not going to change environmental standards, if they're all on one side of the equation, and you think, well, shouldn't that give us, even the most dim-witted liberals, shouldn't it give you some insight that you're either A, too stupid to understand what's right in front of you, or you're intentionally ignorant so you have some plausible liability? Well, we thought, if we voted for her, that she would then do the right thing. Well, do the right thing based upon what? Based upon Bernie Sanders, intentionally, in my opinion, with malice aforethought, leading millions of young idealists who don't know a twit about the world we live in into the encampment of we're going to change the Democratic Party. Okay, you think so? What happens when the emails come out, Bernie, that shows that there was an intentional conspiracy, a cabal with Podesta, Hillary Clinton, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and others at the Democratic National Convention to completely tilt that entire democratic process so it's no longer democratic, it is biased on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Now, if you found out, Danny, that you're supposed to be running with no one putting their hand on the scale for either side, and they not only had their hand on the scale, they had a boulder on the scale, wouldn't you at least protest? Wouldn't you go forward and say, I believe that we should have an open discussion on this and hold Hillary accountable and her minions accountable for this? Instead, not a word out of Bernie. No protests, no lawsuits. He continued to go out there like the Pied Piper of Happy Dust Time and say, Hillary's the one. And I'm thinking, wow, Chris Hedges had it right. Michael Moore and the entire left had it wrong. The true progressives had it right. The others were wishful thinking and delusional. They had it wrong. So now you know exactly what's going to happen. You know that Israel's going to go after Iran. You know that we're going to put NATO around every country in surrounding Russia. And yet ask yourself, since when did Russia invade another country? Since when did Russia become the problem and a threat to our security? That leads me to, first of all, before we go forward, if you have anything you'd like to challenge that you find I'm wrong in saying just now, it's your opportunity to challenge me.
No, I hear you, Gary. The challenge that we have right now is to, as they say, is what is to be done right now. We're trying to figure out what it is that needs to be done. I believe that right from the very day of the election, what has to be done is there has to be a decision made to organize the progressive caucus inside the Congress, all of those 75 Congress people who in fact come from places where there are major universities, We need to organize the universities. We need to organize those 75 congressional districts. We need to organize the Progressive Caucus to set forth a full-scale political platform that is an alternative to the policies that Hillary Clinton is going to be establishing, so that there is a focal point of protest and, as you point out, a mobilization of the mounting of a campaign in 2020 to mobilize a campaign to run a full slate of candidates with a full alternative budget, with a full alternative foreign policy, with a full alternative domestic policy. That's got to happen right from the instant of this, or a week from now, when the election takes place. This has to be a four-year mobilization process of identifying what the alternative policies are in the affirmative, because we have to be able to get off the defensive where we're pointing out all of these things to people, and their hair is on fire. They're going, oh, this is terrible. So what are we saying? The only alternative is to vote for a fellow, a cartoon character, basically like Donald Trump. We have to make it clear that that isn't the only alternative. There is an alternative of setting forth an affirmative, progressive agenda with specific candidates for specific offices, and that is what we need to do. And this articulation of what it is that we're up against, we need to understand that really what we're looking at here is the Samuel P. Huntington Council of Foreign Relations Trilateral Commission basically policy that's going on, and that both the Republican and Democratic Party are supportive of this. That's why so many people inside the Republican Party are freaking out right now, because they don't believe that Donald Trump gets it. He doesn't understand, what the game is here. He's completely out of control. And so what they're doing is they've all come out and started explicitly supporting Hillary Clinton, because she's going to continue this type of a set of policies. So what we need to do is to mobilize the alternative.
Danny,
in the affirmative.
Danny, we're already doing it. We've been doing it. Richard Gale, who myself, we've been in touch with over 1,200 progressive minds, including Jim Garrison, by the way, from around the world. And we're wanting to bring in all the other parties, not just the Green Party, but the other parties. And I even believe that you could have conversations with libertarians showing that half of your values are sensible,
half
of your values are insensible. Are you willing
One of the things, Gary, is a piece of information that people don't understand. Until this past year, the Libertarian Party actually had a plank in its platform at their conventions that specifically called for the passage of laws eliminating the shareholder-owned private corporation, because they believe that state-created entity of an artificial stockholder-owned corporation is, in fact, totally distorting a free market system.
I agree.
And so those libertarians, and I gave a call to Joe, who was the chairman of the party the other day, say, look, you got to get that plank put back in the Libertarian Party platform, and that what we've got to do is we've got to mobilize our people to understand that the vehicle by means of which this cabal is effectuating its policies is, in fact, this newly created business entity of a shareholder-owned private corporation, and that has to be eliminated. It has to be a core premise of this new mobilization. And that is what will then take us out of this foreign policy of attempting to of course, the United States Supreme Court decisions, with regard to giving them the identity of people. It has to be eliminated as well.
Danny,
what we have to do.
Okay, Danny, I would like at some point, if it's possible, to have a meeting with the core leaders of the Libertarian Party to express what are progressive values. Now, I look carefully at every one of their planks. 22 of them are absolutely progressive. 12 of them are absolutely regressive. And if they could eliminate the 12 that are 11 to 12 that are regressive, and then understand what it is to be on the other end of one of their policies, and how it impacts them. Then you bring a humanistic value that's completely lacking. There's a body without a soul, and with Gary Johnson, you've got a head without a brain.
That's right. I know.
He should be in a Walt Disney film.
It's pretty tragic.
It's not just tragic. It's terrible. I want to conclude with one more thought that has not been discussed by the media. The U.S. has given over $5 billion to the Ukrainian expat groups connected with Ukrainian nationalist parties. These are highly racist parties. They are really not good people at all, and they're all fascistic in their ideologies. That's been over the last 5 years. That's the United States government. And that led up to the coup. Now, immediately afterwards, large U.S. corporations like Monsanto and Cargo moved in. So I have to ask, why didn't you look at the real motivation and strategic goal behind the U.S.'s support and interference in bringing about a coup in Ukraine, because it was all United States-backed, to install a neo-fascist, even neo-Nazi government, which we did? And what would have been Hillary and neocon Victoria Nuland's role in the emergence of this repressive anti-Russian nation on Putin's borders? Then how does the Ukraine figure into the expansion of NATO and a strategy to surround Russia militarily? And right now, enormous resources are being put into expansion of NATO and our military. You gave us the background on that. And Obama has committed $1.3 trillion. Let me repeat that, $1.3 trillion, the total amount of student debt. So we have one of two choices: eliminate all student debt, which eliminates debt peonage from these students. But he says no, he doesn't want to touch the profits made by bank, nor does Hillary Clinton. Instead, they're going to put $1.3 trillion to renew and update our nuclear weapons arsenal. And Hillary has said that the use of nuclear weapons is not off the table if she's present. And yet Russia has never been a threat on this, not in the last since 1992. And in fact, Russia only has two military bases outside of its border, one in Syria at the coastal town of Tartarus, and we have over 920. They have two, we have 920, yet we act as if it's Russia that's the threat. And remember, today it is my belief that Hillary Clinton is the new neocon, new American century cartel leader. And this is a great global threat. Besides Victoria Nuland, the wife of neocon Robert Kagan, among the Bush-Cheney advisors you mentioned, we're also now seeing many of the most hardened neocon fascists coming to her support. Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, Christine Whitman, and others. And Nuland herself is likely positioned to be the next Secretary of State. Now, one of the questions Trump consistently raised during the presidential debate is, what has Hillary Clinton actually done and accomplished? And yet, when you ask the media, show us the actual record of what she's done to make it a better world. What has she done for people in unions? What has she done for the poor? What has she done to eliminate the war on drugs? What has she done to have a free medical system? What has she done to defang the military-industrial complex? What has she done to protect American farmers? What has she done to protect us from GMOs? What has she done to stop home foreclosures? What has she done to re-engage the Glass-Steagall Act? The answer is nothing. And also, finally, Danny, and this is important.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Putin. Putin's being considered the new Hitler. Both Obama and Hillary and the Washington establishment accuse him of being an immoral dictator, an indoctrinated KGB official now ruling this nation. By the way, which is twice the landmass of the United States with half the people. Guess who's going to win? Guess who's going to win that battle when it comes to natural resources? And here's what I would like, your final statement.
Yeah.
Americans don't fully realize the deep spiritual side of Putin. He is a man of letters, far more educated than any president since John F. Kennedy. Aside from the great Russian authors such as Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Turgenev listed among his favorite authors, there's also something startling and surprising for me about his Russian theosophical theologian. One of the people motivated him, which was Nikolai Berdyaev, who wrote The Destiny of Man, which presented a new ethics of modern thought that was based upon the spiritual development of the personality and human freedom. And that great Russian author saw ethics as an expression of creativity. Then there is the Russian philosopher Ivan Levin, who wrote The Singing Heart, a book of quiet reflection, which was an early eco-spiritual treatise that deals with the beauty of nature, man's relationship, and responsibility to preserve it. So it's extraordinary as a work because it captures the Russian pathos of having been beaten up so many times in history, but never to lose sight of the beauty during our darkest hours. And then finally, the more Russian Orthodox Gnostic theologian of the 19th century, Vladimir Solovyev, who I believe is one of the great thinkers of all time. And for these three authors were also mystics such as Solovyev. Putin encourages all of his ministers to read and will frequently quote them during his political addresses. And finally, he's not a KGB communist, an atheist, that our media wants us to believe. Rather, he is a deeply tied to the Russian Orthodox Church, a devoted supporter and practitioner, and we never hear this about him, about how on his recent trip to Moscow in the Vatican, he went there to strengthen the ties between the Orthodox churches, primarily the Catholic and Russian Orthodox churches.
That's right.
And Putin's favorite theologians and poet is Vladimir Solovyov, who died in 1900. He curiously stands somewhere between Catholicism, his fellow Russian Orthodox have accused him of crypto-Catholicism, and the Russian faith, which Catholics accuse him of Gnosticism. So the main book that Putin recommends to his cabinet, to his friends and ministers, is Justification of the Good, which focused on how the spiritual good might be reflected in politics to benefit society as a whole. Yet, there is another short essay he wrote that is more prophetic than the theological. It's entitled A Short Tale of the Antichrist, and it can be found translated online. And this was written over 100 years ago and talks about the visions of what will happen if we don't make positive changes. So final quick answer, and it has to be a quick answer, why is it that if we, you and I, and others, can know that there's a more complex human being than what we have been told there exists. We've been told there's only one human being, and that is an atheistic, communist, fascist, Hitler, and we're not seeing this actually played out in real terms, and we're seeing a different, more complex human being. Why is it that the media has never presented this? Final thought.
Well, the reason that the media has never presented this is because the media in the United States is owned by the same kind of corporate oligarchs that, in fact, the policies of the cabal are made to support. And that's what's happening here. It's a major propaganda machine. And I was very impressed by the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church and that their desire to be genuinely spiritual. And they all praise Putin. That Putin is a rather extraordinary person who's very much enlightened with regard to his understanding of Gnosticism and the deep spiritual traditions of Russia. And that was the fundamental mistake that the Soviets made in the Bolsheviks, that they were atheistic. They didn't understand what true spirituality was. And that's what Francis is in the process of attempting to get organized now, to bring that type of genuine spirituality in Russia back into unity with the church and to purge the Roman Catholic Church of the fascists that in fact rose to power under the Pope Pius XII, who signed the Concordat with Hitler and Mussolini and Franco. That's what's going on now. Francis is engaged in a major effort to bring all of the Catholic Church together under a genuine spirituality. And I'll say in closing that there is strong evidence to indicate that the third secret of Fatima that has been so much talked about and no one can quite understand, in the various popes, John Paul II and others, didn't want to reveal what this was. There are strong indications that what it's really saying is that the re-spiritualization of our people in the human family will come out of Russia.
Danny, we're out of time.
That's what they're afraid of.
Danny, let us continue on a progressive commentary hour for the hour, talking about your trip to Italy, your trip to Russia,
yes.
And that's a whole different discussion. But I thank you for sharing this conversation through Remarkable Minds Hours with us. Danny Sheehan, DannyPSheehan.com or RomeroInstitute.org, the author of The People's Advocate. Thanks a lot, Danny.
Terrific. Thank you, Gary.
Danny Sheehan. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.